now approaching. Junction at platform. Passengers, airport, please stay on board. Next stop, road station.
iOS helps you control which apps you share your exact location with. There's more to iPhone.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
This is the Game Football Podcast from The Times. Today, is Cristiano Ronaldo papering over cracks at Manchester United? Why are Chelsea so disjointed? Manchester City are happy despite defeat. And how the mighty have fallen in Spain. This is The Game. Well, what a week it's been in the Champions League. Shock results and shock performances. We're going to look at all the English side's games. We'll start with Wednesday night before we take a look back to Tuesday and a little peek ahead as well to the weekend's Premier League action. I'm Hugh Wizencroft, joined by Ian Hawkey and Gregor Robertson of The Times today. Gentlemen, how are you?
Very well, Hugh.
Good, thanks, Hugh.
Good, good, good. Let's start with the game in Turin then. A win for Juventus over the defending European champions, Chelsea, who had 74% possession on the night, 16 shots, but only one on target. I wonder whether they were woeful or whether this was a defensive masterclass from Juventus. Ian, I'll start from you. What was it? Where was the balance?
Juventus, I thought, defended extremely well and most unlike themselves so far this season. I thought Matthijs de Ligt was good. Leo Bonucci was Leo Bonucci. And quite a makeshift Juventus team, you know, looked really on top of things and looked as if they knew their plan. I think it was, a bit of an eye-opener, both for anyone who's watched Juventus a bit this season and possibly anyone who's been watching and purring over Chelsea for most of the last 2 months. A really engrossing Champions League game, I thought.
What was so eye-opening for you about Chelsea in particular?
They didn't come up with solutions, you know. The thing that Thomas Tuchel's been really good at is seeing what isn't working and solving it, you know, to put it broadly and rather simply. And I think he got out-cunninged by Max Allegri overall.
Gregor, what did you think about Mason Mount being out of the game? He's missed the last couple of games, in fact. But when Ian talks about them not finding a solution, they have been a little bit more disjointed. They didn't get anything going in attack against Manchester City. You know, they didn't seem to have that comfort with Hakim Ziyech and Kai Havertz, with Romelu Lukaku. There's no chemistry there yet. But I think Mason Mount almost makes them tick. How much do they miss him?
Yeah, very much so. It's often when a player's absent, that's when you kind of you recognise that. There's a reason why he played more games for Chelsea than any other player last season. Why, no matter who the manager's been, they've trusted him and played him. And I think I was reading in the last 180 minutes, they've not scored and they've only had one shot on target. The main thing is that Lukaku's looked kind of isolated and he's cut a bit of a frustrated figure. I mean, part of this is to do with the quality of the opposition, and I agree with Ian. I think Juventus, there's a bit of the kind of Chelsea under Tuchel about them defensively. You know, they covered space really well. They were very compact, really hard to break down. So you have to give Juventus a lot of credit. But at the same time, Lukaku was kind of waving his arms around in the second half. He was wanting deliveries played in when they weren't, and Ziyech and Havertz were both pretty ineffective, I think, in that kind of space, trying to link the midfield and attack. I think you have to give Juventus credit, but I think from Chelsea's point of view, the sooner they can get Mount back, the better. This is a blip. I expect them to bounce back very quickly.
On Lukaku, though, there's part of me that thinks we're seeing some things about him. I know he cut a frustrated figure, but we're seeing some things about him that were said about him when he was at Manchester United, maybe not Inter Milan, but lack of vision, lack of touch, maybe a lack of movement at times. Obviously, he's far fitter than he was at Manchester United. Is any of that fair for you, Gregor?
I really don't buy it. I feel that there's very few players who, you know, the criticism emerges quite so quickly about as Lukaku after a few games without a goal. I think a lot of the issues, you know, a lot of the reason we're seeing Lukaku look frustrated is because of the kind of disjointedness of the team and what, you know, the kind of attacking play around him. He was billed as the kind of final piece in the jigsaw. You know, it looked like the jigsaw was a bit scrambled in the last couple of games. So no, I think people are far too quick to cast aspersions on Lukaku's talents. I think he looked like he was often trying to pin one of the best central defenders in the world. Perhaps you could say he could have been looking to try and run off the shoulder a bit more, but there seemed to be too much space between him and the midfielder, whoever was going to be delivering those passes. Again, the wing-backs weren't as effective as they have been for Chelsea, which has been one of their greatest strengths under Tuchel recently. So no, I certainly wouldn't lay any of the blame at the door of Lukaku.
It looks like they'll still go through as well in this group. You'd expect Chelsea to be one of the teams who does qualify for the knockout stages, but not the result they wanted, and some work to do for Thomas Tuchel, I think. Maybe a little bit of a wake-up call, as Ian suggests as well, in terms of them being favourites in just about every competition. So many people saying that at the start of the season. Not their best week, it's got to be said. Let's talk about Manchester United next as well, because lots of people were saying that there were big things ahead for them this season. They needed Fergie time to beat Villarreal 2-1 at Old Trafford in the Champions League. Who else? Cristiano Ronaldo with a 95th minute winner. I've got to say, Gregor, Villarreal should have put this game to bed in the first half, shouldn't they?
Absolutely. I thought they were excellent. And Bournemouth's Arnaud Danjuma looked like a kind of absolute world beater against Diego Dalot, down Man United's right. He was excellent, but Dalot wasn't, just to put it kindly. That back four in general just looked quite delicate. You know, Varane had a bit of a mistake in the first half. It could have very easily been punished. Telles, not entirely sure defensively. Big fan of Bill Edgar's stat that Alex Telles is the first Alex to score since Sir Alex left the club, though. And it was a fine goal. But, you know, United were reliant upon a superb strike, just a moment like that. And then
set piece.
Yeah.
Which, by the way, was a dive. Sorry, Mason Greenwood, but went down very easily. Delighted maybe with it as a Manchester United fan. Fantastic finish. But from a Villarreal perspective, that's a goal that they probably should have stopped.
Yeah. But as I say, that was a brilliant strike. Then Cristiano Ronaldo at the death. It should not, you know, as the headline, I think, in the Times today, it should not paper over the cracks. This was a pretty poor performance from Manchester United, and they were very, very fortunate to win. Still kind of, you know, you don't want to sound like a broken record, but it still doesn't look right in midfield. McTominay with Pogba and Fernandes kind of around him, but he looked really exposed, and there was big spells, long spells, where Villarreal were kind of playing it around him with relative ease. So, yeah, I think Man United were very fortunate. And I think, you know, you can't always rely on these moments. I just don't think it's going to last in the long term for Manchester United. So they need to find a way of breaking down opponents and actually dominating the play a little better.
Big questions about Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, especially from Manchester United fans. You know, that performance had once again divided their fan base. His acumen as a coach being questioned once again. You know, so many people saying, you know, Emery is the better coach. You could see that on the night. He just didn't have the same talents in his team as Ole Gunnar Solskjaer did. And five substitutions helping a squad like Manchester United's as well, when you can throw on a Lingard, you can throw on a Cavani when you need a goal. But I do think some of those criticisms, Ian, are fair. And it's boring for podcast listeners to go back and back again and us to talk about Ole Gunnar Solskjaer. But performances like that with a squad like his make you start to think that he can't be the long-term. I say start to think. Remind you once again that he's probably not the long-term answer for Manchester United. What are you thinking?
First of all, I think that to be outcoached by Unai Emery is no great criticism. You know, he's a really, really good coach and better, more experienced managers than Ole Gunnar Solskjaer have been outcoached by Unai Emery. But yeah, having said that, the Champions League has not been very flattering to him so far, has it? There's substantial integration to do this season. Varane, Sancho, Ronaldo to an extent, I guess, or at least accustoming the team to playing around Ronaldo. I wouldn't be inclined to get rid of him in the short term. He's pretty clear about what the target is. And I think he knows as well as anybody that given the squad that he's got, he's got to win a trophy. I quite like a lot about Solskjaer.
I'm surprised. I'm surprised. Listen, at least it's balance on the game podcast. You know, it's not all of his fault. I felt for Scott McTominay, and it's not all Ole Gunnar Solskjaer's fault. When I saw the lineup, I thought Pogba would play alongside Scott McTominay. But the issue is that even at halftime, I was like, right, he's got to make changes. They've been completely outplayed. Scott McTominay's totally isolated. He's not making the right angles to get on the ball. He's basically non-existent. You know, he's not doing anything. I wouldn't have taken him off, actually. I would have taken Jadon Sancho off. And yeah, I've got to say it, I would have put Fred on next to Scott McTominay, just because it doesn't matter, you know, it doesn't matter how you want to play. You've got to, you can only use the tools that you've got. And actually, I thought that would have given Manchester United more stability in the game. But it's going to be the story of their season. We're going to come back to their midfield again and again, so I can't labour it. But if anyone thinks Man United are going to win the Champions League with this squad, as good of the players that they have, I mean, it was for me, it was, you know, as a Manchester United fan, you're watching once again, you're wincing, saying, we're not going to win the league. We're not going to win the Champions League playing like this, you know. And that's sad to think, you know, six or seven games into the season when you've got a squad with as many talented players as Manchester United do.
Just on McTominay, Fred, that midfield access that's much maligned. I was reading this morning that Man United's win percentage with those two is 10% higher. They score more goals, they concede fewer. So as much as it looks, you know, you look at that and you think, should that be a Manchester United midfield? It gives them that platform. And it just doesn't work all the time. Look, Fred has had some stinkers in his time at Old Trafford. But it's probably the best option because it doesn't work with Pogba alongside him there. And then just on Solskjaer, you know, I'm with Ian. I think I like him. I think he seems like a good guy, and he's kind of he's got the connection to United. There's a lot of positive things you can say, but it just comes back to that fundamental question: is he the guy who's going to win the title for Manchester United? Is he going to take them close to the Champions League kind of latter stages? Is he even going to win a trophy? That's the question. And so you can like him, you can think he's making progress, and that question still for me remains a no. So I think eventually Man United have to make a decision about that.
I'm sure we'll be analysing Ole Gunnar Solskjaer more before the end of the season. We'll see exactly what the Champions League holds as well. But I do want to mention David De Gea's performance, Ian. It looks like he is getting somewhere back towards his best. Ole Gunnar Solskjaer was talking about the extra work that he's put in during the summer as well. He could be massive for Manchester United this season.
Yes, and as you know, as he's been massive for them in many seasons, he is a puzzle, De Gea, isn't he? He's you know, he quite understandably divides opinion, because you can see his flaws, and you can sometimes see things that you think must be some sort of lapse of concentration. But there's, you know, there's no questioning the really high level of natural ability. And you know, he's still young enough to have, as a goalkeeper, to have a long time ahead of him. So I mean, it will be interesting to see in the fullness of history how David De Gea is looked back on. I mean, you know, it could be as one of the great United goalkeepers ever. But that is an encouraging aspect of United's slightly patchy picture from the early season is David De Gea's form.
Just finally on Manchester United, Gregor, it was still a very positive end to the game, especially inside Old Trafford. We hadn't had fans for a European game, I think, for 18 months or so. You know, fans staying inside the ground. Viva Ronaldo, you know, the lift that he has given the club seems to continue. And a bit like Messi, who we'll speak about later, you know, peripheral for big parts of the games, but when the key moment came, he delivered, and that's why he's at Manchester United, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, that's why he and Messi are spoken about in such rarefied terms. As they, you know, as you say, there was moments where he's kind of taken a poor touch, or he tried to lay it to the side, and he was robbed. You know, he was pretty poor, in fact. I wouldn't even just say he was, you know, not involved in the game. I thought it was a pretty poor performance up until that point. But and there is always he always manages to produce a but when people are having these conversations. And he was there. It was a kind of a fairly average cross from Fred, I think it was, and he, you know, managed to nod it down into know, some people may have just tried to put that right back across goal. It was like a very deliberate kind of little header into the path of Lingard. And Lingard did really well too. We have to give him credit to hold off the defender and lay it off. And yeah, there he was. So it, look, these guys are the best, among the best who've ever lived for this reason. No matter what, they kind of, they'll always find a way to influence a game. And Ronaldo did it again.
And if Manchester United are going to have a chance in any of those main competitions this season, he is going to be key to it. We'll see if he can help lift their form as well in the coming weeks. That's Manchester United and Chelsea wrapped up. Up next, we'll talk Manchester City, who seem to be delighted with defeat, and Liverpool keep marching on. Stay with us on the game. Well, the huge game of the week in the Champions League saw an Abu Dhabi versus Qatar derby as Paris Saint-Germain beat Manchester City by 2-0. The strange thing about this for me was the way in which it was sort of seen as a positive by Manchester City that they just lost the Champions League group game by a couple of goals. They had 55% possession away from home against Paris Saint-Germain, 18 shots, compare that to just 6 for the hosts. But they were beaten by 2-0, Gregor. So what are they so pleased about?
I don't know. I mean, I thought they played well. I think we have to say that. I think, particularly in the first half, they largely dominated. I think, you know, this was a game between a team of individuals and a team that's kind of structured, coherent team. And the individuals won out on this occasion. Well, we know why that is. You know, 2 moments decided the game. And that can happen. I think City played pretty well. You know, as the stats show, I think even XG shows it was 1.9 to 0.8. They had by far the better chances. The Sterling's and Silva's double miss, that was a huge moment in the game. But there was a lot of positives. I thought Cancelo was really good again. Some of his kind of passes threaded between, there was one right to the back stick for Silva that was cut out brilliantly. Grealish growing in, he looks very much at home in the Champions League, even though he's playing against an elite defender in Hakimi. I think there were positives to take. You just have to look at, the first goal was kind of Mbappe, there's no one better at skipping beyond a defender, there's that moment of explosive pace and getting to the byline and cutting the ball back. And even then it was a bit of kind of misfortune. City had a lot of players around the 6-yard box. It managed to find its way through to Gay and he finished well. And then the second goal was the little maestro doing what he does best after doing very little for most of the earlier 70-odd minutes. So I wouldn't be too down if I was a City fan. I think if I was looking forward in the Champions League, I would rather be Manchester City than PSG.
Why? Just because of that one performance?
No, because of the fact that they are... at the moment, they're smashing teams 5 or 6, or they're struggling to break them down. That's the only worry. And I know you've said many times they need someone in the box to finish chances, and that was proven again. But I think more often than not, a team with City's, as I say, coherent play, and they look like a team, will win more games than lose. And I think PSG are standing on fairly... It's a fragile kind of plan to have such a divide between the midfield and the defensive 7 and the front 3 who you say, go on guys, win us a game, because they might not do it every week.
Ian, what do you think then? Would you rather be Manchester City or Paris Saint-Germain at this point in time in the Champions League?
I'd be even more pleased to be PSG, because what they don't do very often is smash teams recently by 5 or 6. You know, they win quite narrowly even in France, which is probably a better league than some people make out. So I think that was genuinely a statement performance for them, obviously a reverse of the semi-final. And I think Pochettino will be very pleased that PSG held their own in midfield. I think, you know, Verratti was outstanding against a City team who tend to dominate that territory. I wouldn't say it's a threshold. I mean, it's obviously a threshold because Messi scored for the first time and the front three have actually combined. But I think the global view will be that this is the kind of progress we really want.
I'm not going to labour my argument about Manchester City needing someone to score in the penalty area, but you are right in saying, Gregor, it was proven once again. I'm not going to, because I'm sure we're going to come back to this with Manchester City throughout the season. The one thing they don't have, a bit like Manchester United, who we discussed a little bit earlier on, is Messi or Ronaldo, someone who can even though they've got so many great players, you know, that elite talent, that one of the greatest of all time talents, someone who can, and by the way, I didn't even notice because I turned the game on after about 90 seconds and I hadn't seen the lineups. I noticed Lionel Messi in the 45th minute just before half time. I was like, oh, Messi's playing. Genuinely couldn't believe it. But he shows once again why, in my opinion, he's the greatest of all times with a stunning goal. Ian, I just want to come back to what Gregor said. If that is to be the mold for Paris Saint-Germain, to wait for a Messi, a Neymar, and Mbappe to do something incredible, can they really win the Champions League like that?
Well, I think if Mbappe continues to play as he has for the last few weeks, yes, because you don't really have to wait for Mbappe for very long to do something match winning, either creatively or as a finisher. So provided he stays fit and he stays content, which is something to watch in his case, they have the best equipment up front. I think there is quite a lot of positive feeling around PSG now. And yeah, as long as Mbappe is on board, buying into the project for at least till the end of the season and staying fit, yeah, I think they do have that, the near complete jigsaw.
There's no doubt there's a lot of positive feeling. I mean, the moment Messi's goal hit the back of the net, you kind of, it was like a wow moment, wasn't it? That was his arrival. And I think everyone there kind of acknowledged that. And it was quite, you know, that was a big, big moment. But as you say, you reference Cristiano Ronaldo, someone who can win a game, Messi who can win a game. Sure, PSG have got a few of those players. But I would still rather be a team like Manchester City, who have got 11 players playing in tandem, plus another 4 or 5 in the bench who could come in and do that as well. I would rather have that in my arsenal than be so reliant on whether Messi can produce a moment of magic.
Let's see if they buy a striker in January then, Gregor. Just on that though, Ian, that liftoff moment Gregor referred to for Lionel Messi at Paris Saint-Germain, how big a moment was that goal?
I think hugely important. And also for Messi himself, you know, I think that's, you know, he is under enormous pressure. He needs to show that he can be the same footballer as another club. So I think more important than for the club, PSG, and for Pochettino and for the fans, it's for Messi himself to believe, you know, that it's still there. And he's, you know, he's able to build the right relationships with the likes of Mbappe. Because that, you know, that's the part of the magic triangle that needs to be explored. He's played with Neymar for 4 years before. They really like each other. He hasn't played with Mbappe before, and you know, that's the link that needs to be strong and needs to be built. So I think all around, you know, dissecting that goal, I think that's a really important moment for the player himself.
We will see if Lionel Messi continues in the same vein for Paris Saint-Germain and whether City can start putting the ball in the back of the net when it really counts. I still think that's an issue, but I will come back to it. As you know, I like to labour my points on the game podcast. Let's move on though to a team who didn't really labour in their match away in Portugal. Liverpool went to Porto and grabbed an impressive 5-1 victory. Both Mohamed Salah and Roberto Firmino both scoring twice. Pretty irresistible again, you've got to say, from Jurgen Klopp's team. And a certain young English midfielder, Gregor, Curtis Jones, with a fantastic performance as well, reminding everyone that there are many more young English talents coming through, not just the ones who went to the Euros.
Yeah, he was outstanding. You know, a big influence against Brentford as well last week. So, you know, when Harvey Elliott was the player who was... He was taking that position in midfield from the start of the season. Obviously, his injury was a huge blow. But when you've got Jones coming through, he's definitely softened the blow so far. And he was brilliant. He's very direct in everything he does. Very kind of positive, and you know, willing to take the kind of the responsibility on the pitch, I think, to try and make things happen, despite playing in a team with so many huge stars. You know, I think he could have a really big season for Liverpool, and that was an area of the pitch. You know, we said that Fabinho and Thiago kind of trying to form in a decent partnership now, but Jones, I think Jones is that extra player in midfield after Wijnaldum's left. There's still like in a position to be won there, and I think he's making a big case for it so far.
Ian, what do you think about Roberto Firmino versus Diogo Jota? Firmino got a couple of goals off the bench, but Jota started the match alongside Mane and Firmino, which is a position, of course, very familiar for Roberto Firmino. But does Jota add an extra dimension that means he should be starting ahead of Firmino now that he's coming back to form?
Yeah. I thought you were going to ask about any Liverpool striker against the poor Porto goalkeeper Diogo Costa, who did huge favours for everybody up against him. He does do something very distinct from Firmino, and I guess it's a strength to have the different options. I don't know about the rest of you, but I get the very strong instinct that at the moment Jota is in the ascendancy, and Firmino is going to have to, you know, fight harder for his place probably than he has for a number of years. But you know, he's still a very, very poised, experienced, unselfish guy to have in your front three, isn't he? And he showed that the other night. It would be interesting to know. I think they wouldn't divulge it willingly. What Salah and Sadio Mane thought about, you know, what suits them best from their very, very established and very refined roles.
Yeah, it's an interesting one. The Klopp's Three Kings was pretty much the, you know, the reaction in the newspapers, making out it was all about those three once again back together. But of course, I think you're right about Firmino having to fight for his place. There's something about the direct nature of Diogo Jota, the work rate as well, that I think is working well for Liverpool right now. You mentioned the Porto goalkeeper. Ian, I've just got to ask you, can you remember a worse goalkeeping performance in the Champions League? I mean, it seemed like he had a bet on Liverpool at times. I'm not going to curse aspersions over him, but my word, what was he up to?
Unfortunately, I think you probably knew what the answer to that question was going to be. I can remember a worse performance involving a Liverpool goalkeeper in a Champions League final not so long ago. But
I was wondering if you'd mention that.
I mean, poor fellow. And I mean, you could tell, couldn't you, from the bench that Sergio Conceição, his manager, was preparing an almighty bollocking for afterwards.
Well, Liverpool go marching on, as I say, in the Champions League. They have got a big match, though, in the Premier League this weekend. In the end, it's a top-of-the-table clash, in fact. They're hosting Manchester City. Who do you think the favourites are going into that match, Gregor?
I think these games have been very notoriously hard to call, and they've been actually quite tight, a lot of them, in recent seasons. So I still think, although Manchester City lost this game, they were imperious against Chelsea at the weekend. I still think that they probably are narrow favourites. There's no doubt Liverpool are getting back to very close to what we know as Liverpool at their very best. You know, that real kind of high pressing, high intensity dynamism, that, you know, that kind of... That's Liverpool at their very best, and they are getting close to that. So it promised to be an excellent game. But I would just narrowly favour City personally.
Yeah, I'm with Gregor on that. I think Liverpool are clearly gaining some momentum, but in a sense it's still from a further way back in terms of getting their big players who were out for a long time right back to total sharpness. I mean, I'm not saying I'm detecting flaws in Van Dijk or whatever. I just think, as you said, we look in one place really for Manchester City's flaws, and that's, you know, the absence or makeshift or revolutionary idea instead of a centre forward. I think City have looked very accomplished, and the win over Chelsea is, you know, that's quite a statement to take into the domestic season. So marginally City.
Where do you think this game will be won and lost finally on it, Gregor? Where's the key area for you?
I believe Trent Alexander-Arnold will be out. So, you know, whether they stick with James Milner right back, that's potentially one week's. But although James Milner, no matter, people say this, I've said this many times before, and he's some specimen, that guy. So I think it's going to be in the kind of transitions when City notoriously is their biggest weak spot is in behind, and Liverpool, that can be their greatest strength. So I think City are more accomplished in terms of kind of breaking down teams when the, you know, the intricate movements are in the box. I said it again in the first half, particularly against PSG, the number of times that City's wide players and Grealish in particular are just getting into that little channel down the sides of the box, the penalty box, and the danger that he poses there. And if it's Mahrez on the other side, I just still think that City do that better than any other team. And it, And then even, you know, if it's De Bruyne or Bernardo Silva in the little inside channels where they can play, work one twos, play the cross into the box. I think that is City's biggest threat. So, I mean, there's lots of places you can see this game's won. I think it's got to be whoever, you know, whoever's pressing with the most efficiency, I think, in those kind of transitions, those turnovers of play.
Great game this weekend, though, in the Premier League for us to react to on the Game podcast on Monday. So don't miss us. We will be back then. Still more to come today, though. Up next, we're going to continue our conversation about the Champions League and ask what's happened to the Spanish giants.
VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on, settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books, contacts, calendar, double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility, there's more to iPhone.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Well, there were two very, very surprising results in the Champions League this week, and they concerned, well, maybe one wasn't that surprising, but they both concerned teams in Spain and the big names in Spain as well. Let's start with Real Madrid. They were beaten at home 2-1 by Sheriff Tiraspol, Sebastian Till, with an absolutely fantastic last-minute strike for the Moldovan champions, who, by the way, have 2 wins from 2 in their maiden season in the Champions League. Ian, I've got to start with you on this one. Is this a surprising result for you? How surprising? And also, you know, I wondered about Real Madrid this season, whether they're in fact better than we thought they would be despite this result.
Yeah, I mean, it's clearly a surprising result by any metric. The venue, the history, the prestige, all that. We were aware that Sheriff are quite useful. They won their first game against Shakhtar Donetsk, who were also quite useful. They are very well organised. They counter-attack really well. You've seen that in both their games so far. A little shout-out. Their magnificent attacking left fullback, who's called Cristiano, not to be confused with the other Cristiano. But yeah, he's really caught my eye during this Champions League. But at the same time, Real Madrid can say we didn't have an awful lot of luck that game. I think the goalkeeper, who was also magnificent, made 11 really good saves. The shots numbered into the 30s. So, to answer your other question, Hugh, yes, Real Madrid, they're not an utterly damaged force. They've played pretty well at times this season, and their young players have played well, Vinicius in particular. Also, Eden Hazard has had his moments, which has not been something you could say for most of the last two seasons. So, I don't think this is a very embarrassing result for Real Madrid, but I don't think it's a catastrophe.
Now, I've seen mutterings on the internet, read a few stories about Sheriff Tiraspol. Are they really the fairy tale some might believe?
To have a Moldovan team in a Champions League for the first time ever is a good news story for anybody who believes that the competition should be spread to more remote corners of the continent it's supposed to represent. Okay, so having said that, Sheriff Tiraspol's relationship with the Moldovan League is peculiar. They utterly dominate it. I think 19 of the last 21 titles have been theirs. They also, their belonging to Moldova as a nation state is in debate for a lot of people from Tiraspol, because they come from a region of Moldova which likes to think it's autonomous and behaves in a lot of autonomous ways, and we gather from referendums and so on, would like to be an independent country, Transnistria. All of which is by the by, but they are far better funded than any of the other clubs in that league. However, you know, they're not far better funded than most clubs taking part in the Champions League group phase. You know, you go through the team and you won't have heard of many of them. they're picked up from all over the world in what is, you know, quite an accomplished scouting network. You can pick at all sorts of things that you might not like about Sheriff Tiraspol, but I think it's quite nice to have a new club doing something a little bit special in this competition.
There are undoubtedly some pretty shady goings on in terms of the way they're financially backed. But I mean, there's part of you that kind of looks at that and thinks, could you not say that about quite a lot of football clubs in the Champions League now? And in fact, that, you know, you see the domination of the Moldovan League. Real Madrid and Barcelona have won 17 in the last 22 in La Liga. I know that's two clubs, but they are so far ahead, and Real Madrid have had some questionable funding as well. So above all, it was just a remarkable win, a huge shock, and undoubtedly the most embarrassing. Well, I would say probably the most, without knowing deeply the Real Madrid's history, I would say probably their most embarrassing ever result, really.
Yeah, big defeat. Just in terms of the size, the magnitude of the result, and a great moment for Sebastian Till scoring the winner as well. Got to celebrate it rightly too. So Real Madrid beaten, and yeah, that was a shock. And the team that I say maybe wasn't a shock is Barcelona, because they lost their opening match by 3-0. They were beaten once again last night in the Champions League by 3-0, this time away at Benfica. The boss, Ronald Koeman, is under extreme pressure. He's told us not to compare this Barcelona side to teams of old. Ian, is that remark fair? Are the players good enough at Barcelona right now to be compared to any of their previous sides?
Well, in some ways, it might be wise to say, actually, no, we should start comparing these sort of nights with the recent past, because Barcelona only lose by 3-goal margins in the Champions League these days against anybody who's got any distinction. You know, this goes back to being knocked out by Roma in 2018, 3-0, having been well ahead in the first leg. Then there was the Liverpool comeback. Well, there was the really big one, by an 8-2 in the quarterfinals. Last season, what, Barca 1, PSG 4. I could go on. Juventus 3, Barcelona 0. And 2 weeks ago, Barca 0, Bayern 3. So there we are. 3-0 is pretty much standard now for anybody who fancies playing this very, very ragged Barcelona. But yeah, clearly Koeman's right that we shouldn't compare them with Barcelona a decade ago. Benfica fans weren't listening to that. I think it should be said on Wednesday, because they were chanting Messi, Messi, Messi a lot of the time as they revelled in what was Benfica's first win over Barcelona since the 1961 season, I think. Yeah, anyway, so, you know, there's all this. There's this massive pile-up of history looking down and sneering at current Barcelona. Koeman is in an extremely difficult position. He knew that when he took the job, and his tasks were to ease the wage bill, which has gradually seen Luis Suarez, Lionel Messi and Antoine Griezmann leave. His one alibi really is that he will promote from within. He hasn't got much choice about that. He is criticised for the way he's doing that, some muddled thinking, some confused formations. And frankly, some of the Barcelona homegrown talent is not being very helpful. Eric Garcia, who rejoined Barca from Manchester City in the summer, has now been sent off twice already this season. So, you know, the idea that La Masia, the academy, will produce all the solutions, as it produced a lot of solutions and some absolutely brilliant football 10 years ago, it's not so straightforward. It's very, very hard to see a medium-term recovery even for Barcelona. And it's very hard to see Koeman still in a job in 2 weeks' time. In fact, by the time listeners are enjoying this, you know, they may well be reading that that Koeman is gone. They have a really difficult game this weekend at Atletico Madrid. Atletico Madrid featuring Suarez and Griezmann. So yeah, I think Koeman is not long of Barcelona.
On that point, I mean, who can come in and do anything with this squad of players? I mean, let's put it into this context. is it more Koeman's fault than the talent in the squad right now? Because I look at their lineup last night and a couple of games that I've watched this season. I don't think the players are good enough. I'm not sure what manager is going to get great performances out of them. Am I being too easy on Ronald Koeman in that regard? And Ian, who would replace him?
Somebody who isn't going to cost an awful lot of money in salary, but most importantly, somebody who's prepared to do it. If you are a head coach who can pick and choose to a certain extent, you would see that while the praise for resurrecting this Barcelona would be huge and well deserved, why would you go there now with obvious budgetary problems, an obvious gap between what the veterans have left? I'm talking about Piqué, Busquets, and when the talented younger players will reach the right stage of maturity. It's a very bad time. But the list is, at the moment, Xavi is obviously a popular choice, the former captain who's working in Qatar at the moment, and doesn't seem that inclined to jump or volunteer himself very loudly at the moment. Roberto Martinez, much loved in the Premier League, is also a candidate for the Barcelona board. If he can be prized away from Belgium, he's from the area, and he talks a very good game in terms of style, which is always presentationally important at Barcelona. Otherwise, some sort of stopgap from within. I think having a candidate who knows the club or knows Catalonia is probably important. And as I say, I'm afraid a candidate who isn't going to ask for huge amounts of money is probably quite important.
Ian, tell us a little bit about the internal salary cap at four Spanish clubs in La Liga, because there have been changes this week and they're really interesting. Just having a quick look at them. Barcelona's salary cap has been slashed, I mean massively slashed here, by about €285 million a year. It stands now at €97 million. Compare that to the other clubs, you know, Real Madrid, well, it's the highest. It goes from €470 million to a whopping €739 million, a full €642 million more than their rivals Barcelona, but also more than the other sort of top four or five contenders for the Champions League combined. It's stunning, really. Just tell us how it all works and why it was brought in Spain.
Well, it's been going for 8 years, and it is a reform which the Spanish League, who run it and govern it, and whose clubs have signed up to it. I mean, it was an agreement that the clubs make to avoid the dangers of bankruptcy or whatever, that clubs are subject to an audit to see what their projected income is going to be in the forthcoming year. That is then processed by the league, and the league set a spending limit. Now, spending means transfer fees and salaries, essentially. An important issue now has been the closed stadiums during the pandemic. The degree to which attendance is important varies a lot across clubs, and it's probably more important overall in Spain than it is in the Premier League, which has enormous television income. And it's even more important for a club like Barcelona, which has a huge stadium, nearly 100,000. So that's been empty. So that partly explains why they have dropped in terms of their the money they have available. Only partly. They've spent a huge amount of money on players who have not worked out and therefore haven't had any resale value. Their total debts are above €1 billion. So this is all factored in because those debts have to be serviced. So the league study all this and have decided that it is only safe for Barcelona to be allowed to spend just under €100 million. Now, by the time you take into account some of the salaries they're obliged to pay, that leaves them very little money. And in fact, that will leave them scratching their heads about how they can find the money to pay off, say, Ronald Koeman, if and when they choose to get rid of him. So it's that bad. Real Madrid are a better run club at the moment. They, like Barcelona, bring in a lot of money. And Real Madrid have also done better in terms of the sales of players in the last few years. And they have, you know, they have a fabulous brand. They are now back in a renovated Bernabeu too, so they can confidently predict that income through turnstiles is going to go up. That's why they look so much better off than Barcelona. But this is more about, you know, the plummeting stock, as it were, of Barcelona than Real Madrid having been absolute whiz kids economically.
It's going to be big decisions to make for Barcelona on the horizon. Ian, thank you for letting us know all about that. Not long to go on the game podcast. Up next, though, we'll be talking about ex-players and whether they should become referees. Stay with us. It's been mooted this week that there will be a joint initiative with the PGMOL, the FA and the PFA to try and get ex-players at the end of their careers into refereeing. Now, we've got our very own ex-player here, Gregor Robertson, who's written a little bit about this week, and I'm sure that application is going in soon. We might see him in the middle of a pitch somewhere. Gregor, I've got to ask you, as an ex-player, what you think about the idea of going out there and being an official and whether it would really help the game?
Well, there's two answers to that. The first is kind of, you know, footballers know exactly the kind of treatment that referees get because they're the ones who give them it. I'm not sure they're going to be, an influx of applications for this. That's the first thing. The second thing is, I don't know, I just think that this is not new. There's been a push for ex-players, recently retired players, to become referees for quite some time, and it's never really happened. I just think the premise is fundamentally flawed, basically. It kind of groups players into sort of a homogenous group. For example, Kevin De Bruyne's challenge in the Champions League the other night. From my point of view, I don't think that should have been anything more than a booking. Took a cursory glance at Twitter and I saw a former teammate of mine, Padraig Amond, who you might know from FA Cup exploits with Newport in recent years, say, how on earth did Kevin De Bruyne not get away with that one? So I think there's this kind of idea that footballers, because of their experience, would read the game differently and they would read it in a certain way. And it's not true. He's a striker, as a defender. We have our own kind of bias. And I also don't think that necessarily because you played the game means you read the game better. I think that's a fundamentally flawed premise. And I think, you know, I wrote about this, as I said, I wrote about this week, and I even kind of branched that off into journalism and into coaching. I think it's quite something, you know, Martin Ziegler referenced in his report, Neil Warnock saying, at the weekend, you didn't have to look far at the weekend for someone. And Neil Warnock's often a good place to look, saying that, you know, referees, they've never played the game. You know, it's a kind of throwaway, dismissive phrase that I've heard for 15 years in changing rooms, and I've still heard since I've been on this side of the fence. And the longer I've been out of football, the more I've felt that that is a flawed premise. I think that just because you haven't played football doesn't mean you can't appreciate things and put yourself into a certain situation. I just think it's also slightly disrespectful to the kind of, you know, there's referees have put in about a decade of practice and study and work and experience to becoming referees. And we might be in a bit of a crisis at the moment in terms of officiating. I think a lot of that's to do with the rules rather than the referees themselves. So I think, you know, football's good at trying to fast track former players into associated roles, but it's a completely different job. And I don't think just because you played football would mean necessarily you were a good referee.
I think AC Milan and Wolfsburg would probably agree with you on that one. Maybe they would actually want a change after the decisions this week. Ian, how do you see it?
I think there's a degree to which having an ex-player who had played at the same level as the players he was officiating would earn some respect, which would probably be important for the image of the game and possibly the confidence of referees generally. But I'm not sure how far beyond that it would go. I'm inclined to agree with Gregor on this as well, that you know, that you get as many different sorts of ex-player as you do different sorts of ex any other profession. And it's not necessarily an automatic track to expertise in making these very difficult decisions.
Gregor, I personally want to see you out there, mate. I think do your badge, do your courses, you know, and get fast-tracked and let's see you out there in the Championship.
Well, that's another thing. You know, the level at which you play is another important factor. I played in lower league football primarily. So my experience of of football as a sport and how it's officiated is pretty different to the Premier League. So that's another thing you've got to say. You can't, you know, you have a very different experience to call upon. But I would also refute the fact that you would have immediate respect, as Ian suggests there. I'm not sure that's true. I think referee, a lot of refereeing is about control and how you kind of, you hold yourself on the pitch. And I don't think having been a player or not really influences that.
Greg, I'm just interested in asking, do you think your opinion would be shared by most of your contemporaries who you played with?
Absolutely not. I mean, I wrote this piece yesterday, and as I say, I broadened it slightly into coaching, because there's still an attitude within football that if you're a coach, an aspiring coach who hasn't had a professional career in football, you're somehow, your understanding of the game is not quite as profound. And as again, I said it the same in journalism, there's people who have studied the game for decades and, you know, very astute observers of the game, but their views can be dismissed because they're not being professionals. I think that's flawed. I think in any walk of life, it's how you can call upon those experiences and it's a new skill. Refereeing is a different skill to playing football. Coaching is a different skill. You've got to be able to call on your experiences and have a new skill to be able to teach it, or to be able to control a game, to be able to interpret the rules properly. As I say, I think a big part of the issue of refereeing at the moment is the rules and the kind of this uncertainty that was created as well, because of VAR.
Do you think ex-players would be good as VAR officials? Maybe not out in the middle of the pitch, but better in the booth in Stockley Park?
Maybe, but I still think it sort of ironing out flaws in the rules is more important. And I would harp back to, just because you played football doesn't mean you can't have a stinking opinion about a decision or something that happened on the pitch. I've seen it many times. I've seen it by coaches. I've seen it by teammates. Sure, you might understand. You might think that players understand the game better, but that doesn't mean that you could interpret an action or a phase of play better in real time.
I like that. What better way to end the podcast? Equality in terms of stinking decisions. Both ex-players, journalists on the Game podcast with stinking opinions week after week. That's the way we like it. That's the way it should continue. Listen, thank you for listening to the Game podcast this week. Remember, you can download and you can subscribe right now. So go to thetimes.co.uk/thegame to get yourself 1 month free of our award-winning journalism from both The Times and The Sunday Times. And if not, we will see you on Monday reacting to all the big stories in the Premier League this weekend. See you then.
iOS helps you control which apps you share your exact location with. There's more to iPhone.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.